Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to begin the book of Exodus today. This, like Genesis, is one of those pivotal books that without the information, both theologically and historically, the rest of the Bible is almost not understandable. Here we have the major themes of the culmination of the covenant with Abraham, clear back in Genesis 12 and 15. We have the development of a loose tribal group into a unified nation, and we move through the care and love and provision and grace of God. Exodus shows us that the Old Testament is not law. The Old Testament is grace, just like the New Testament. God is fulfilling His ancient promise and love before the commandments and the law and the stipulations of the covenant are ever given. This book has been much discussion about authorship, of course, and it's caught up with the authorship of the whole Pentateuch, or called the Torah, or the five books of Moses. Now, this book begins, and these are the words. And these are the names, the Deuteronomy, and these are the words. It's interesting to me that we break these up only really for ease in handling, because really, Genesis through Deuteronomy is a unified historical account with legal stipulations like the book of Leviticus and part of the book of Numbers, and to that extent, Exodus 19 and following. But still, it's a historical movement from creation to the calling of a people. Now, because of that, I think the authorship of all of the Pentateuch is linked in this issue. However, even in the book of Exodus, several times it says, "And Moses wrote." That's found in Exodus 17:14. It's found in Exodus 24, verse 4 and verse 12. It's found in Exodus 34, verses 27 and 28. Now, when you combine with that other places in the Pentateuch where it says that Moses wrote, and that would be Numbers 33:2, Deuteronomy 31:9, 31:22, and 31:22 through 26. You get the idea that Moses wrote most of this or part of this. Now, I agree that there has been some later editorial additions. Obviously, Moses' own death was not recorded by him, probably by Joshua. But anyway, there's been some editorial additions. Now, in the Jewish circle, Ezra is the one who edited the whole Old Testament, though some say Jeremiah did. So I'm not saying that Moses wrote every last word, but for me, the bulk of the material is Mosaic. It has been reworked by Jewish scribes on a limited degree, but the bulk is Mosaic. Now, to go along with these things in the book that says, "And Moses wrote," there are several places where it says, "And Moses spoke." God told Moses, and Moses spoke these things. Most of them are found in the book of Deuteronomy, and they're in your notes, your outlines, if you receive those. And also it says God spoke through Moses again extensively in the book of Deuteronomy. And since the book of Deuteronomy also starts, "And these are the words," you see the whole thing is seen as a literary unit. I want to mention also that the New Testament quotes quite often that this section of Scripture we know as the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Bible, was written by Moses. Jesus attributes this to Moses in Matthew 19:8, and the parallels in Mark 10:5. Also in Mark 7:10, Luke 16:31 is a really good one. Luke 24:27 and 44, John 5:46 and 47, John 7:19 and 21 is where Jesus attributes this to Moses. Now we have the author of Acts, Acts 3:22. Mentions Mosaic authorship. Paul, Romans 10:19 and 1 Corinthians 9:9, mentions Mosaic authorship. And also the author of Hebrews, chapter 10, verse 28. So we have the book itself says Moses wrote. Other parts of the Pentateuch, seen as a whole, says Moses wrote. The New Testament authors say Moses wrote. Jewish tradition has been unanimous that Moses wrote. Moses had the special training in the Egyptian court to be able intellectually, linguistically, to write this. And then finally, archaeological evidence confirms the historicity of this book. I think Moses wrote it. Now, when we come to date, there have been two major opinions. There's not much historical corroboration for the Exodus because, of course, the Egyptians wouldn't record this humiliating defeat. But we know several things. There seems to be that the Egyptian capital is in the Delta region. That's a clue. It also seems we have a transition of two kings. A Pharaoh grew up who did not know Joseph, and then another Pharaoh grew up later. Now, with that kind of information, there have been two major theories. One goes to the Bible itself, particularly to 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, where it mentions that from the Exodus to the reign of Solomon is 480 years. Now, kind of playing with that is a generation 70 years, is a generation 40 years, a generation 25 years. You can come with different dates. But if you go back to the building of Solomon's temple, and most folk would make that somewhere around 965, somewhere close to that, and you subtract 480, you get somewhere around 1445 B.C. for the date of the Exodus. And that's been the traditional date, 1445. But with more archaeological evidence, we have found that basically there seems to be a better date based on a way to interpret the Bible and also the evidence from archaeology. And the date for there seems around 1290 B.C. Now, the reason for that is as follows. Seti I, who we think is the Pharaoh of the oppression, and he reigned from 1309 to 1290, moved the capital from Thebes, which is way in the south of Egypt, to the north, which is in the Delta region, which fits the historical documentation, and he was the first to do that. When it says a Pharaoh that knew not Joseph, we know from history there was a period of Semitic rulers in Egypt. They're called the Hyksos, or shepherd kings, and they would be Semites, and they ruled in Egypt from 1720 to 1570 B.C. Many of us assume that's the group to which Joseph worked for, because he was also Semitic. And it mentions in several places that Potiphar was an Egyptian, which seems kind of funny. They all should be Egyptian. So many think that this was the previous dynasty, and then a new Egyptian dynasty came, which Pharaoh Seti I was a part. So the traditional date of 1445 would be the 18th dynasty, and the newer date, based on archaeology, would be 1290, which is the 19th dynasty. Now, if it's about 1290, and we have 40 years of wilderness wandering, then at 1250, we have found extensive archaeological evidence that the major cities of Canaan were burnt with fire. And apparently a newer civilization took over and rebuilt a much inferior level than the previous architectural design. This seems to fit the conquest of Joshua. So for my opinion, I would say that Seti I is the Pharaoh of the oppression, and Ramesses II, 1290 to 1224, is the Pharaoh of the oppression. The name Ramesses is also mentioned in the book of Exodus as one of the store cities that the Hebrews built. And, of course, Ramesses means son of Ra. And we know his name from several accounts, both in Egyptian literature and here in the name of the city in the Bible. So that's why I personally hold to a 1290 date. Well, now, what about basic content? Does this book fall into some major categories? Yes, it does. And I'll give you a fourfold content breakdown, if I could. Chapters 1 through 11 is Israel in Egypt. Chapter 12 through 18 is the Exodus and the movement to Mount Sinai, which I think is in the southern Arabian Peninsula. And then number 3 would be the legislation given at Mount Sinai, which would be chapters 19 through 31, and continued in the book of Leviticus, of course. And then major break number 4 would be the receiving of the Ten Commandments, and then the account of Aaron's golden calf, the rebellion and renewal of the covenant. And that would be chapters 32 through 40. Now, as far as a basic purpose of the book of Exodus, I think I have 4 major purposes. Number 1, it shows the development of a nomadic family into a settled urban nation. Number 2, it shows the fulfillment of God's promises and bringing them into the promised land. Number 3, it shows God giving them the covenant stipulations that are personified in the Ten Commandments, but also issue in a detailed description of the tabernacle and the priesthood. And finally, it shows God's great love and care for His people Israel and the beginning of the line of the promised seed that will culminate in the Messiah. And there are many parallels between the life of the patriarchs in Genesis, but also the life of Moses and Joshua to our great deliverer, Jesus. Now, I do not want to get into allegory, But I do think there are some obvious ways that God took a small beginning and mushroomed it against all obvious opposition into a great spiritual blessing. And I think we can see that once we get into the book itself. Now, with that, let's begin with Exodus chapter 1. Notice it says, "And now these are the names of the sons of Israel." It is obvious by the term "and" beginning this book, it's connected to Genesis. And also, we're going to rename the tribes. Now, they were named in Genesis 46, verse 8 and following. But the order of the names here in Exodus 1 really go back to the order found in Genesis 35. So it's the author's way of really linking in the book of Exodus with the history of Genesis. And, of course, the term Exodus, which is basically from the Greek translation, the Septuagint, ek, out of, and odos, or hodos, a road or a way. So it's the road out of is the word for Exodus. And we get that, of course, from the Greek translation. Notice it says the sons of Israel, which of course would be the sons of Jacob, his name was changed to Israel, with his households. Now, the word households can mean tribes, families, or it can mean a larger group. It's used for a large number, so we're not exactly sure the number here, but everybody left. Let's see. And notice verse 5, "And all the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70. Now, if you read Genesis 46:27, it seems to be a larger number. If you look at the Septuagint, the Greek translation, it says 75 persons. And this is what's quoted in Acts 7:14. Now, we found some other manuscripts at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, that also have 75. This seems to be adding in Joseph's family that was already in Egypt, Manasseh and Ephraim and their children. And that's how we get the number 75 versus the number here, 70. You might want to compare Genesis 46:27. Now, as it mentions, verse 7, "But the sons of Israel were fruitful, increased, and greatly, and multiplied." Now, here we have three words, fruitful, increased, greatly, and multiplied. It is not by accident. These are exactly the verbs that are used in Genesis chapter 1, verses 21 and 22. So I think it's an obvious link back to Adam, who was commanded to be fruitful. But this is also linked to the Abrahamic covenant that says they're going to be like the stars of heaven, the dust of the earth, the sand of the sea. Going back to Genesis 15:5, Genesis 26:4, Genesis 28:14. Now, what this means primarily is that this is a culmination not only of the command to Adam to be fruitful, but of the promise to Abraham that his particular family would be fruitful, and we see the theological development that begins here. Now, notice if you would where it says, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph." Now, I really think that we have to have two kings here. One that arose that did not know Joseph, a new dynasty, probably Egyptian dynasty. One that's going to move their capital to the Delta region, and also that's going to die, and another Pharaoh come on the scene, which would be the Pharaoh of the Exodus. That beautifully fits, in my opinion, Seti I and Ramses II. Now, the word king here is later down in verse 11, the word Pharaoh, which means great house, and became to be a title for all the Egyptian kings who were believed to be the son of the sun god Ra. That's why Ramses, Ra, and Moses, we think, is a title that comes from son of, so it'd be son of Ra. Now, notice if you would where it mentions in verse 10, "Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply." I'm amazed in this chapter how many times the word multiply is used. In verse 7, it's used quite often. In verse 9, it says, "They are more and mightier than we." They become afraid of the Egyptians, of the Hebrews, because they had multiplied so greatly. And there was another Semitic empire on the scene, the Hittite Empire. And I guess Egyptians were afraid that the Semites outside the borders of Egypt would link up with the Semites in the borders of Egypt and cause another overthrow. I think they were paranoid about the Semites that had reigned earlier in Egypt, the Hyksos, and this seems to fit the historical setting better. Notice verse 12 is mentioned. Verse 20, the Hebrews multiplying is what caused this problem of wanting to kick them out. Now, of course, remember we said in Genesis, the reason they went down to Egypt is because the Egyptians didn't like other foreigners, and they pretty much isolated them, and this family got to grow into a large nation without the Canaanite influence of which they were becoming a part of in the land of Canaan. Now, notice it says, "In the event of war, they will join themselves to those who hate us," probably the Hittites, "and fight against us." So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. Now, this metaphor of hard labor is another theme throughout this first chapter. Notice in verse 11. Notice in verse 12. Notice in verse 13. Notice in verse 14. And the words in 13 and 14 is the word to crush with labor. Now, they're trying not only to put them under severe labor, but they're trying to work them so hard they won't have time to make love and have more kids. There's the problem. There's so many kids. The rabbis say, and boy, all the women choke on this. The rabbis say they were so fruitful, they were having 6 children at a time. Holy moly, how would they have 6 kids at a time? I prefer the hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh store cities of Pithom and Ramses. Now, Pithom means the house of Aten, and Ramses means the house of Ramses, probably a royal residence. And I think we can see these, we don't know where these are, but we think they're in the Delta region, of course, because Ramses is a king who reigned in the Delta region. And then it says, and the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out. Well, obviously, their countermeasures to stop the fruitfulness of Israel were exactly the opposite. And so they continued. And so they were in dread of the sons of Israel. Their paranoia was growing, okay? And the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor vigorously. You know the story about they wouldn't have had to make bricks, and then they had to make bricks and gather their own straw and all that's going to happen to them. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwife. Now, this is unusual for several reasons. Why are only 2 mentioned? And second, isn't it unusual that 2 women would be addressed personally by Pharaoh himself? Well, now, Rashi says that these 2 women were the head of a guild of midwives. That's possible. There's been some discussion about, were these Hebrews or were these Egyptian women? Well, knowing the Egyptians' hatred of the Hebrews, it seems impossible almost that they would serve to birth their children. The names here seem to be Hebrew names. The first one meaning splendor or just girl, and the second one meaning beauty or fair one. Now, these 2 midwives, some say, well, they must be Egyptian because it seems to be unusual that they believed in God, feared God, and God rewarded them by giving them a family. And the implication is a family in Israel. But that's reading way too much in this text. All we have is what's recorded here. And it says there were 2 midwives, probably Hebrew. They're addressed for what reason, we don't know. Did Pharaoh himself do it, or is this a literary way of saying they were informed by Pharaoh's decree? I'm not sure. But anyway, here's the decree. When you see the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool. Now, this birth stool was apparently 2 rocks, a flat rock and an uplifted rock. And women in this time, and to many pagans in the Orient still do, they're very vigorous workers. And so that they don't have any time in the hospital for children. They have their children by natural childbirth. They take a few hours and they're back on the job. They would go to this stone and they would squat down, hold on the stone with their hands. The child would be born on the flat stone. And so it was a metaphor of the birthing methods of the ancient world. If it is a son, you shall put him to death. If it's a daughter, he shall live. Now, of course, they wanted the girls because apparently there was some intermarriage or they didn't care about the girls. They just didn't want the people to increase. Now, notice if you would then. But the midwives feared God. That's kind of put in here as an unusual thing. And they did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. Now, that's a direct disobedience to the command of Pharaoh. Okay? Notice what's happening. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? Now, there's been a lot of discussion through the years. It's amazing on this how many different ways this chapter is interpreted. A lot of deal about them lying. Can God use a lie? Augustine developed this a whole lot. Philo talked about this. Were the midwives really making a lie, or is it true with Calvin that this is just what really happened? The Hebrew women, because they worked so hard, had their children so fast that the midwives didn't get there in time. Well, I'm not sure it's a lie or if it's occurrence, but it does say that they weren't afraid of Pharaoh because they were more afraid of God. And so the Hebrew women had their children so fast they couldn't help them. So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very great. And look at verse 21. It came about that because the midwives feared God, that he established households for them. And the implication is being he gave them a husband and children, or the implication is that they had an inheritance with the people of God. Now, we know from other parts of Exodus that a mixed multitude is going to come out of Egypt. Apparently, there were some Egyptians that believed and exited with the people of God. Is this who these midwives are? We just can't tell. And Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, notice we move in several different stages. The Egyptians are afraid of the Hebrews because they're so many. So he tries to stop their fruitfulness by working them very hard, puts taskmasters over them. That did not help. It even exacerbated the problem. So he gets this apparently guild of midwives and threatens them and says, you kill the boys. Keep the girls, kill the boys. But that doesn't work because midwives say these women have their babies too fast and we can't get there. So then he says, kill the boys, right? And they don't do that. So he tells all his people now, not just the Hebrews themselves, not just the midwives, but all the Egyptian people. He says to the Egyptians, you start killing these kids. Now, that's what he's going to do with them. Every son who is born, you shall cast into the Nile, and every daughter you shall keep alive. Now, why into the Nile? Well, the Nile, of course, is one of the major gods of Egypt. We're going to find in the next chapter that the daughter of Pharaoh, and if it's Ramses, by the way, he had 59 daughters. Oh, my. How many pantyhose do you use with 59 daughters? But whatever. So the daughter is going to go to the Nile to bathe. Now, in India, you may know the Ganges River is holy. And the Indians bathe themselves in the Ganges as a sign of religious worship. It is quite possible that this going to the Nile to bathe or casting these children in the Nile was some kind of a religious act, either a sacrifice to the god of the Nile or had a religious connotation. We're not sure. But anyway, that's what's supposed to happen. Now, let's see. And every daughter you shall keep alive. Exactly why they should keep the daughter alive, I don't know. And this begins, basically, the book of Exodus. If you look at the commentary by Childs, it's interesting to me that as he goes through not only the exegetical basis, but the history of interpretation, there have been several lines of interpretation in the book of Exodus. Number one is, there is going to be some unfortunate things happen. We've got midwives lying. We've got Moses going to kill an Egyptian. The next chapter, we've got some other things happening. The Jews all try to explain their way out of this by putting up a circumstance where all these people act in godly ways and appropriately. The history of the church, on the other hand, has sometimes struggled with this. And it seems that God, if he doesn't advocate these inappropriate actions, he at least allows them for a redemptive purpose. And so what we have here is an attempt by the church. There's two major lines in the church. One, to deal with the moral issue of lying and murder and how could these people do it in God's name. And the other one says, no, the bigger purpose of Exodus is the act of the redemption of the people of God. Now, isn't it amazing that God seems to start in circumstances that seem no way they can be fulfilled? He calls this one man and he has a barren wife. And most of his children are going to have barren wives. And so we have God having to act in supernatural ways to fulfill his promise to Abraham. Now, from Genesis 15:16, it was predicted they would go down into Egypt. It's predicted they'd be enslaved for X number of years. And it's predicted God would bring them out and give them the promised land. Now, here again, we have the situation where the Egyptians, who are the power structure, they are the status quo, are really putting these Hebrews down. But instead, again, instead of the barrenness of these Hebrew women because of the extra pressure and the threats of death and the death sentence on their kids, instead of it getting smaller, it's mushrooming. So we see the presence of God, the supernatural presence of God. This is one reason why I think in the book of, I believe it's 1 Corinthians, Paul says that all Scripture was written for us. Now, as a hermeneutical specialist, I don't believe that means we can allegorize the Old Testament and say that Moses is a type of Jesus or Joshua is a type of Jesus or Isaac is a type of Jesus. I'm nervous about that. If the Old Testament is particularly quoted in the New, then that's fine. But just to go back through and find Jesus on every page of the Old Testament bothers me. But on the other hand, I certainly do believe that you can see trends in these books. Not only in Genesis, but certainly in Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and Joshua and Judges, trends of God. moving into his world in supernatural ways with redemptive purposes. And the purpose is not just the Hebrew people, but it's all people. Notice how God's going to work with patience and love with the Egyptian people. There's going to be many Egyptians that come to know the Lord through these plagues, and God's going to bring them with his own people in the promised land. So I think once you see these themes, it becomes extremely significant. So as we begin this new book, I hope you'll think back in your mind on how God, the pattern of God working with people in Genesis, is the pattern God repeats in the book of Exodus. The pattern of the people's acts of faith mixed with doubt is repeated in Exodus. And also, as the people know God's will, they try in their own human effort to fulfill it, and disaster occurs. That same thing will occur in the book of Exodus. Well, I hope this has been a good basic introduction, and I've really enjoyed being with you, and we'll cover chapter 2 next week. Until then, may God bless you. Have a good day.